You're listening to The Leonard Lopate Show on AM 820 and 93.9 WNYC.
After successful runs in London, two of Shakespeare's plays, Twelfth Night and Richard III, are currently in repertory at the Belasco Theater here in New York until February 2nd. The productions aim to replicate many of the conventions of Shakespeare's time, most notably having all the women's roles played by men, which in the case of Twelfth Night means having a male actor dressed as a girl pretending to be a boy. Doing repertory also means that on every Wednesday, Mark Rylance performs something like the Iron Man Challenge of Theater, playing Olivia in the matinee and then Richard III in the evening. I'm very pleased that he, along with Paul Chahidi, who plays Mariah in Twelfth Night, and Hastings and Tyrell in Richard III, and Stephen Fry, one of the few cast members who manages to keep his trousers on at all times, playing Malvolio in Twelfth Night, have all joined me in the studio. Hello.
Hello.
How is it possible that a production of a 400-year-old play can still take Broadway by storm? Did you get equally great reviews in London?
We were, I think, treated very nicely. I think I can speak for all three of us and say that we don't read reviews, but you somehow know, you absorb osmotically whether they've been bad or not by how low the gaze of the producer is cast towards the carpet.
And people still talk to you.
I think what I love is to hear people say, oh, my goodness, that was such an original production. And they don't know the half of it. They're actually speaking ambiguously and perfectly, and in each case, it is original because almost nobody has seen it done like that since it was originally done like that.
But Paul, Stephen just mentioned not reading reviews. Is it true that initially in London, the critics are forbidden from reviewing these plays move to the West End?
Yeah, we do. We do have. In Twelfth Night's case, we only had a 2-week run at the Globe, so I think they were holding off so that we could get the reviewers in once we started in the West End. But Richard III was reviewed at the Globe, but we have a very different system here. I think in the UK, the reviewers come on one night on the whole, called press night, and then they post their reviews. Whereas I think we have. You call them previews here, but the reviewers come in throughout previews.
Now they come in on opening night, but then again, there's the internet that
is there. It
everything.
Felt like they were reviewing all the way through. Mm-hmm.
Now, Mark, you've said that you like working with a director who allows the actors some flexibility to keep the performance new. Mm. How does that work in a situation like this?
What in these two plays?
Yeah.
Well,
keeping the performance new.
Well, just that the playing, the foundation for the playing is to do with what the characters need, what they're trying to obtain in their lives, and the obstacles that they're facing, whether they stand on the left side of the stage or the right side of the stage, or close or far apart. Those are how it manifests, but they're not the foundation. So I like a director who works on the on true foundations of inner need.
Tim Carroll is the director of these two productions. Did he have to make many adjustments in the move from the West End to Broadway?
Did he have to make many adjustments?
I don't think it was a difficult move.
It's a wider stage.
The Belasco is still a fairly intimate theater.
Very intimate, more than the Apollo.
I call it a wide smile. It's got a lovely sort of smile.
And it's a beautiful old theater.
Wonderful.
Maybe we had to cut a little bit from Twelfth Night because of the union overtime. If we'd run a bit late. Yeah. But that's all we
do. You socialist countries, honestly.
Is it true that in Shakespeare's time there actually wasn't a director, or would Shakespeare, as the playwright, head of his company and actor, have been a de facto director?
Well, we see Hamlet directing, don't we? And we see one of the mechanicals. I can forget
Peter Quince.
Peter Quince.
Yeah, Midsummer Night's Dream.
But I don't know that there's certain... I don't think there's other evidence of there being of Richard or Cuthbert Burbage being a director.
No.
It's a relatively new thing.
Actors just... Would you like that? Well, just let the actors figure out where they should be at all times?
I've tried that.
What's happened?
If I was a contemporary of Shakespeare's and I was playing a major part and he was sitting glumly in the somewhere in the Globe watching a rehearsal, I'd ask his advice.
Hey, Bill, do you think I should be here or there? What about reading this line?
But it is fascinating that in Hamlet, he gives Hamlet that amazing speech where he he tells the player king how to perform. You know, don't saw your hands with the air, so as many of our actors, modern actors, do, but speak the, you know, suit the action to the word and the word to the action. And that's the famous thing about art being a mirror up to nature. And I think it shows that even back then, true artists like Shakespeare didn't want to see hamminess. And there are quite a lot of examples in Shakespeare where hammy acting is made fun of.
The New York Times just published a long article on acting Shakespeare well. What do you think makes for a good performance in Shakespeare? A number of actors have said to me, the trick is to simply trust Shakespeare. Just read the lines as he wrote them. Is that how it works for you, Paul?
Well, I have a great respect for other actors' approach to Shakespeare, but, I mean, for me, I think it is a marriage of technique, which you definitely need, and an understanding of the verse and how to use it, and instinct. But you definitely need... It's like anything. The more you do it, the better you get. But, you know, you need a marriage of the two.
Well, you say the verse, and that's because in these plays, there's an awful lot of rhymes that you have to let the audience know are rhymes, and at the same time not make a point of.
That's right. I mean, ironically, my character Mariah in Twelfth Night is exclusively speaking in prose. Stephen has a bit of verse, and Mark has a lot, but you know, it is a demand. But you know, it's strange that I think part of the way we're doing the production is that you'll see us entering on stage, getting dressed, and you're entering this imaginary world and joining the journey, and people are prepared to make that leap, and you know, you can make that journey with an audience.
Yes, that's a very important point, actually, is to advise people, if they do come and see it, is to come a little earlier than they usually would, because we get dressed and into our costumes on stage, which is an unusual sight.
Do you see that as a performance?
I think, well, no, not as so much as a performance, as a kind of breaking of the ice. People still think of Shakespeare as some kind of medicine that they have to swallow, you know?
For exams. And so forth,
if you see cheerful actors cheerfully talking to, talking to each other and talking to the audience who sit on the stage, because we have two lines of, two what they're known as standings, two boxes on the side of the stage where the audiences sit.
Is that the way it would have been in Shakespeare's time?
The
standings.
Britain's a very seasonal country. It's not like...
they would have been standing in the front of the stage. Like, and then seats.
This is designed.
It's not like Los Angeles, you see. The point is, the Globe Theatre, everybody knows about it, and that's fine in the summer. Occasionally it'll rain and everyone will laugh. But in the winter or in plague years, it's just simply too dark to perform, and the actors.
I remember
get as much
when
money
I lived there,
possible.
It rained a lot.
Well, yes, and it would have done in Shakespeare's day, and indeed the phrase goes, "The rain it raineth every day," is a line from the play. So if you think about it logically, it's perfectly obvious that a theatre company for half the year is going to be looking for places to play inside, and the only natural places would be Oxbridge colleges, and law. Halls, they're called the temples, middle temple,
inns of court.
Inns of court. And in fact, this play, Twelfth Night, was first performed in 1602 in the middle temple. So you're playing in noblemen's houses or in Oxford colleges, as I say. And so Shakespeare wrote different kinds of play for different kinds of place. And Twelfth Night is a country house play. It's a play set in a house with staff of stewards and so on. And it's not like Richard III, which has battles, and it's much more in the style of the earlier historical Shakespeare.
And would the set and the stage be pretty much the same as it was during Shakespeare's time?
Well,
do we know?
This set that we've brought... This set has what's called a hall screen at the back with two doors and a raised balcony at the top.
And people enter through the doors as much as they do from the side.
And that's a very accurate oak replica of a hall screen at a college called Wadham College. And it's very similar to the hall screen at the Middle Temple Hall, where, as Stephen was saying, Twelfth Night, we know, was first recorded to be performed.
But and these were permanent structures. They weren't built for the plays. I just want to say that, sorry.
Those are permanent structures, the hall screens.
So every play would have been performed in front of those.
There's different theories about that. Some people feel maybe not, but I think they would have performed in front of those hall screens. And then the standings, which are like scaffolding, were erected temporarily down the sides of these long rectangular halls. And so the settings are pretty accurate.
My guests are Mark Rylance, Paul Shahidi, and Stephen Fry, three of the actors in Twelfth Night and Richard III, now playing in repertory at the Belasco Theater, and they'll be there until February 2nd. You have striven for accuracy to the point where Twelfth Night is spelt T-W-E-L-F-E. Oh. Is that the way it would have been?
On your program, yes.
Yes, it was on the 1623 folio, which is the most authoritative text, as far as we can tell.
The other day we had Stacey Keach on the show, and he said that American actors shouldn't affect British accents when they're playing Shakespeare. Well, Mark, since you lived in the United States from the age of 2 until you were 20, couldn't you do it either way?
I have done it either way, and I would agree with Stacey, yeah. I would agree. I think when I first arrived in England, there was a terrible thing I had to learn at drama school, which was called received pronunciation, mm-hmm. or standard English, which was a nowhere speech. And thankfully, now in England, you'll hear all the different regions, Yorkshiremen and Welshmen and Scotsmen, and everyone using their own accents. And I think that's very important, rather than some kind of idea of a standard or a correct accent, and
yeah,
I love hearing Shakespeare in true American accents.
Well, there have been recent studies that from scholars that suggest that Shakespeare sounded kind of like Cornwallian.
That's right.
That's
more,
right. Yeah,
or Virginian.
And why not do that? As long as you're doing
we
the,
have
the
done
costumes
that, at times.
That you were wearing, look to me like they must have been very similar to the ones.
Yes,
that
except
were worn
of course,
in Shakespeare.
Shakespeare was writing plays about kings, and he was writing plays about princes, and he was writing plays about peasants. And you have to delineate the characters, and one of the ways you delineate them is costume, but another way you delineate is voice. And it would be equally as wrong for everybody to do it in American as it would be for everyone to do it in standard English.
The
glory of America and English is that there are hierarchical voices, just as in a white telephone movie of the 1930s there's a kind of cab driver's voice and there's a butler's voice.
But isn't it true that Elizabeth of the First couldn't understand Drake or Raleigh or one
yes.
of them because his accent was
so Devonian?
The aristocrats sounded very country, didn't they? There wasn't a Victorian refined. Do you think Burbage would have put on an accent when he played a king?
I mean, there are plenty of jokes in Shakespeare in which the dull ignorance of, say, Dugbury and Count Constable is used as the fact that they can't be heard or they make what we now call malapropisms. Mm-hmm. And that there are what you make a reference to, pedants in school, in libraries. Holofernes, for example, in Love's Labour's Lost, who is constantly just being a rather sort of Dickensian pedant. So I think, and there were classicists and classic teachers, and there was a whole group of people known as the Cambridge Wits, who prided themselves on their Neoplatonism and their accuracy of speech and their sense that they understood language better than others did.
And Love's Labour's Lost makes fun of academics.
Absolutely. So I think it would take a huge amount away from Shakespeare to just make everybody speak the same.
Now, Paul, I understand that this is not the first time you've played a woman. First time it wasn't Shakespeare, it was Tom Sapart.
That's right. It was the real Inspector Hound, and I was, I think, 13 at an all-boys school. So I stepped in, and I never thought I'd have to do it again, but here I am on Broadway, no less.
So all-boys schools adhere to the Shakespearean tradition only by necessity?
Exactly. No, I think as we got older, that we did have some interaction with the local girls' school, thank goodness.
Well, what happens when you perform in drag? Does the costume affect the way you approach a role?
Absolutely. I've never been in a production where the costume or clothing has helped me with the character so much. Because when I did it the first time around with Mark back in 2001 into 2002 at the Middle Temple Hall, which we were talking about earlier, where it was originally performed, we did all sorts of sessions with movement and looking at the different physiognomies and physiology and physical differences between men and women and thinking about voices. And, you know, I went full circle from worrying so much about it to just thinking, you know what, I'm going to do it in my own voice with a bit more modulation. The costume gave me the equivalent of 1,000 hours of movement classes with the corset. You could only move in a certain way. We have a gliding movement that we've developed simply because you would trip up apart from anything
I was wondering
else.
About that. It looks like you're on roller skates or
Mark has particularly perfected that. It's a beautiful, beautiful thing to behold.
Now, Mark, we also, before the play starts, we see you get laced up rather tightly. Mm. And I wonder whether that has an effect on your posture, on your voice, as well as the way you perform that character.
It definitely has an effect on the posture. It has an effect on your ability to breathe. So when she gets very agitated and excited, it's quite hard to get as much oxygen as you're used to getting in. So it does have an effect that way. But
which allows you to faint to some effect.
Which, yeah, allows me to faint.
But we mustn't run away with the idea this is all incredibly new. When I was at Cambridge, it was the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Mummers, a club which had been founded by Alistair Cook when he was there, and Michael Redgrave. And the idea of the club was to allow women to play women's parts for the first time in Cambridge's 760-year-old history, whatever it was. and the idea was revolutionary. And Michael Redgrave had played Ophelia and he'd played Desdemona in the 2 years before that. And many other, James Mason was a contemporary there as well. So many, many actors that we think of as totally male actors had the experience as children, as youths, as students, of playing women.
Although women did come into British theatre after the Restoration.
They came in the Restoration. Yeah. They could have played in Shakespeare's day. It wasn't that it was a rule against it. It's the audiences didn't want it.
And it's interesting that a similar tradition occurred in Japan.
Yes.
Where men played women. Yeah.
Same decade, too, 1600. It started with all women, first of all, and then that became a bit too exciting, and it went to all men. Well, that became too exciting.
There was always the fear of
as
women
Dr. Johnson
being fallen women.
Dr. Johnson said he never went backstage at a theatre because it excited his amorous propensities.
Well, what about people complain if you cast somebody who's not a Native American in a Native American role? What do your actress friends think about you taking parts that they could have had?
I think it has to be done in moderation, doesn't it?
Yeah.
But there are so many productions of these plays that I think there's room. And there's certainly, it excites me to go and hear the Julius Caesar that was at St. Anne's Warehouse with Harriet Walter and hear all the wonderful performances of that very male play by the group of women there. And at the Globe, we did three productions of all-female cast. So there's a certain sense that a single gender playing the plays might have been appreciated by Shakespeare if he was still here.
I've also seen a woman play Lear. So,
yeah, Catherine Hunter.
Yeah.
Fiona Shaw has played many male leads.
That's right, Richard II.
Yeah.
The notes in the program about the production of the costumes is almost unbelievable. Are all the fabrics authentic? And how did you get deer skin?
And hair?
I think the deer skin comes from Montana or somewhere from an American state out west.
You know what Americans are like. Pick up a rifle, shoot anything. It's lucky it wasn't a human. just as an example, I wear this thing. It's known as a peace cod. It's that sort of
as Malvolio. Like
yes, it's
not now.
Like a sort of it gives you a big tummy. It's supposed to be a sign of, I suppose, some kind of prosperity or virility. Yes, and the buttons on it were cast for this production on a button molder that was made in 1600. It's in the Bath Historical Costume Museum, and I said to Jenny as a sort of half joke when I was being fitted with it, I said, "So these buttons were cast on a button moulder made in 1600. I said, supposing the button moulder had been made in 1603, she said, well, we wouldn't have used it. The play was written in 1602 and performed in 1602. You can have things that are 10 years old, but you can't have something set in the future.
She's remarkable.
And that's incredible. It really
she
is.
She found an Italian gentleman who's the only man who still weaves by hand silk velvet for my black dress and went and employed him to make that.
Extraordinary dress, too.
Yeah. Yeah,
but it looks like it must weigh 100 pounds.
No, it's really light. It's not quite merino wool, but it's like that.
Stephen, isn't this not only your Broadway debut, but also your first appearance at any stage in 17 years?
Yes, that's right. I remember I appeared many times on stage in charity events and other such things, but not in a fictional drama or anything.
Well, when you were here to talk about your memoir, The Fry Chronicles, you told me that you fled the last production you were in, and it occasioned a severe nervous breakdown.
Well, I either had a severe nervous breakdown and then fled. It's a question of which caused which. But yes, I had a very, very unhappy experience with a play. And something in me snapped, and I got in a car and on a ferry and headed for Europe, expecting somehow deeply, oddly, that I would drive up the north of Germany, go to Hanover, to Schleswig-Holstein, and then into Denmark and buy a large, thick white pullover and a pipe and learn Danish and teach English to school children in Denmark, and that no one would notice I'd gone. It was a strange fantasy.
So what brought you back?
Slowly the love of friends and family and a little, you know, incremental improvements in courage and self-belief and so on. It was a strange thing to happen. I'm here now, and I'm very happy to be here now. And one can never say when one is in a particular place that one couldn't have got there unless one had been in a worse place. So
Your portrayal of Malvolio is not typical. You've actually made him a little more human, a little more sympathetic. He's usually just the butt of the joke.
Yeah. I haven't deliberately set about to make him sympathetic. I've just tried to think of things from his point of view. It seems perfectly reasonable, everything he does, and the fact that everybody else finds him amusing and pompous and simply intolerable is their problem, as far as I'm concerned. But I have seen the play many times, and Malvolio has, you know, there are as many Malvolios as there are any Shakespeare character, really. He can be hilarious, hilariously pompous, like Donald Sinden's famous performance. He can be sour and bitter and unhappy, and like other performances I've seen. You just have to, I mean, it's an old cliche, but you find the bits of yourself that aren't Malvolio and throw them away and hope that the bits that remain that are Malvolio are the ones that people see.
Was that true for you as well as Olivia, Mark? Yes. Because this is a character who can be played in a wide range of ways.
I suppose so. I think Stephen said it very well. Yeah, you try and see the story from the character's point of view, and she's very similar to a wonderful woman who lived at that time called Mary Sidney, the Countess of Pembroke, who lost her brother and father in the same year, and that's the Countess Olivia's situation. So she moves from a very wintry situation of grief and rather extravagant mourning, commitment of seven years mourning, into this spring burst of love and passion.
Well, I've always wondered why she dislikes Orsino so much. He seems like a fairly decent chap. And he does start off the play with one of the great lines from Shakespeare. music be the food of love.
Unfortunately, she's not there to hear that, so if she'd heard that line, it might have changed everything. I have to hold my ears backstage or it would ruin the performance. No, it's a good question why she doesn't, but she's adamant that she can't love him. And she says he's got all these wonderful qualities, but...
But you can't love anyone, actually. You're not seeing any men, are you?
No. No, though, at that moment, this rather handsome girly boy is...
You're shocked into discovering that you're a cougar, essentially.
I've become a cougar, yeah.
A listener has written in to ask, she says, I'm curious about the comic timing in Twelfth Night. Does it vary from night to night? Do you ever almost break? Because it could get rather manic.
Yeah. We have to, I mean, it does vary, and that's the beauty of live theatre. It's different every night, and an audience responds differently. But we have to always, we were talking about this the other day before the show, we have to regulate ourselves and not allow the laughter to dictate the way we tell the story. We have to push on with the story first and foremost, but it would be fruitless to deny that there is a lot of laughter in the show, and it's wonderful.
Yeah. But we have to fight that tendency that all actors have to judge themselves by the laughs they get and to feel low if they didn't get a laugh that evening. Mm. But it's not, we're not playing it for laughs. No. I sometimes set myself the task of getting no laughs in this particular scene. And of course, that's
you're an utter
and you
failure.
The night. I was
utter failure, Stephen.
But you do try to. You try to say, well, he's not going on in there in order to be funny. He's going on in there to seduce Olivier, for example, and he's put on his yellow stockings. And he is not. And yet, of course, there's part of one that is an absolutely, completely trampish vaudevillian that wants to hear that sound back, and another part that wants to make sure that it's not cheap.
Now, Mark, I mentioned that you were strapped in for Olivier. What about the contortions that you have to go through playing Richard III? What does that do to your body, and how do you sustain it?
You know, it's more the mental contortions of Richard that I find difficult. He gets, as perhaps all tyrants do, he gets so isolated, and I find myself very dominated by negative thoughts, actually about the performance, about my own performance, which are really just, I think, his own negativity infiltrating myself. So that's more the thing I have to struggle with, actually, is not feeling like I should just give up, really, during it. So the physical thing is just a physical thing that, you know, that.
Well, you've made him less negative than others. He's a little less villainous, and now it turns out latest scholarship suggests that he actually probably was seriously maligned by Shakespeare.
Oh, and Thomas More, yeah.
Mm. No, but nonetheless, I still think, from someone who's not in the play, it's one of the most chilling performances of evil I've ever seen, simply because he is apparently so charming to begin with that it becomes all the more chilling.
I think he has to be convincing, doesn't he? Yeah.
A lot of intelligent people fall for him.
Yes.
Paul, do you think it's easier to play a woman in the comedies than in the tragedies or histories?
Well, you'd have to ask someone who is playing a woman in one of those. But I mean, it certainly. I think it depends what play you're in. I feel very strongly in Twelfth Night because there's an element of disguise already. The added layer of being a man playing a woman playing a man, or just a man playing a woman, lends an irony to some of the lines, which I'm sure were intended when they were first written. Mm. And I'm sure that's there in some of the tragedies too. But anything with disguise, I think, it just adds another layer of complexity that's been very illuminating. And it's not to say this is the way to go with all the plays. And as you asked before, I feel a huge responsibility taking on an actress's role, taking it away from her effectively. And you feel like you want to do it right if you're going to do that.
Mark, is it true that you have been cast as Thomas Cromwell in the TV adaptation of Hilary Mantel's novels?
That is true.
So we won't be seeing you on the stage for a while?
That is true.
What a loss.
It won't be long.
Stephen, I know you've been active in trying to get the British government to boycott the Russian Olympics.
No, not true. As always, journalists are incapable of reading.
You cannot trust the internet.
I wrote a very clear, open letter to David Cameron and to the International Olympic Committee some months ago, urging them to take the Winter Olympics from Sochi and to ask and see if the Canadian government would be willing to host them. They have the infrastructure and they have the experience. It would never occur to me to deny someone who had spent 15 years of their life preparing for the greatest moment of their athletic career by boycotting an Olympic Games. But I think...
that's not going to happen. The International Olympic Committee is not going to move it.
Well, I know, but it's well worth making the point that in the 30s, the IOC didn't say... No, we can't hold them in Berlin. We can't hold them in a country where shops have been destroyed and thousands of Jews have been killed and they're no longer allowed to have academic tenure in their country. We're going to move it to London or to France or to some other place. It's important to make that point because people may say, well, Putin isn't Hitler. Well, Hitler wasn't Hitler at that in 1936.
Yes,
it was a long way from Wannsee and the final solution. And the point is that you have to stop tyrants early, or as W. H. Auden said, little children die in the streets.
My guests have been Stephen Fry and also Mark Rylance and Paul Shahidi, appearing in Twelfth Night. And Stephen, you're not in
Richard the Third. No, I might come on as a surprise prince in the tower with a little squeaky voice. And
he's too clever. You see, he would have stopped the tyranny before the interview.
Yeah, he might have had a breakdown.
He would have written to the director.
They're at the Belasco Theater on 44th Street between 6th and 7th Avenues, a wonderful theater, until February 2nd, and then I guess it's off to other projects. Thank you all so much for being on our show.
Thank you very much
indeed. Thank you.